with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
More than 35 million Americans have chronic kidney disease. An expert from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health will explain why a majority of those patients could benefit by simply following some important updated guidelines. Then a fascinating conversation about heart surgery. A cardiovascular surgeon from the Mayo Clinic says recent developments in minimally invasive heart surgery can result in smaller incisions, less pain, and faster recovery. And each day in the United States, poison control centers receive an average of 32 calls about children exposed to prescription opioids. We'll learn what parents need to know to prevent a tragedy. That's all coming up in a moment on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Nearly 25 million Americans could benefit if they follow the latest guidelines for patients with chronic kidney disease. A highly respected influential organization recommends the target systolic blood pressure for these patients to be reduced to 120. Johns Hopkins analyzed the guidelines and concluded that almost 70% of patients with chronic kidney disease in the U.S. are eligible for more intensive blood pressure management. Joining us now is Dr. Joseph Koresh, the George W. Comstock Professor in the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, the previous recommendation from the group called Kidney Disease, Improving Global Outcomes, was a systolic reading of 140 or lower. So how significant is a decline to the updated target of 120?
This is very important because there are a lot of people between 120 and 140. And there's increasing evidence that people at high risk, if you can lower the blood pressure to a lower level, you can get better health outcomes.
The previous guideline for the diastolic reading was 90. Now, has that changed?
The goal recommended blood pressure in 2012 was updated to 130 over 80 for people with kidney disease. And now the emphasis is 80 rather than 90. But really, for most people, it's the systolic blood pressure that is the rate limiting one. And driving that to less than 120 is, I think, where the focus of physicians should be.
So for context, then, the normal healthy blood pressure is 120 over 80. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I realize that patients' conditions vary in seriousness, but in general, how heavy a lift is it for doctors to get patients with chronic kidney disease down to 120 over 80 or even 90?
I think it's not easy. And step one is to make sure blood pressure is measured carefully and that patients are at rest, not stressed, and getting their low baseline blood pressure. And that may incorporate a strategy of getting blood pressure measurements at home, where patients are more relaxed and you can get more measurements. It's also true that using more medications is helpful in patients with kidney disease.
Now, high blood pressure is a major cause of the chronic kidney disease. Why is that?
The kidney gets a lot of the blood from the heart to filter it, so it's very sensitive to the blood pressure. And as a filter, you could imagine that if you force blood under too much pressure, it damages the filtering units, the glomeruli, and causes chronic damage. And then once you have kidney damage, that further accelerates hypertension because you no longer are able to excrete salt and fluids as well. And as you know, high blood pressure is a risk factor for kidney disease progression, heart disease, stroke, and cognitive decline and dementia. So it's really important to control blood pressure.
So it's a cyclical thing, is it not?
Exactly. There can be a vicious cycle in kidney disease where blood pressure and kidney disease aggravate each other. And breaking that cycle is important with both lifestyle therapies and medications.
We're visiting with Dr. Joseph Koresh from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health regarding updated guidelines for those with chronic kidney disease. Doctor, of the two major types of blood pressure medications, can you summarize for us how the angiotensin-converting enzyme, or ACE, inhibitors work?
Sure. Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors inhibit a critical enzyme. And one of the important things that that does is it actually opens or dilates the artery that allows blood to leave from the kidney, and therefore it lowers blood pressure in the whole body, but particularly relieves the stress on the kidney. And therefore you get the dual benefit of lowering blood pressure overall to every organ in the body, and in addition to that, protecting the kidney better, lowering the protein in the urine, which is a marker of kidney damage, and lowering the rate of progression of kidney disease.
Are ACE inhibitors the most commonly effective medicines in controlling blood pressure?
When there's protein in the urine indicating kidney damage, then there are specific benefits of using ACE inhibitors first or early or including them in an armamentarium of multiple drugs. When there's no kidney damage, many doctors prefer to start with diuretics, which are cheap and effective as well.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about the latest blood pressure guidelines for those with chronic kidney disease. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
Back now to our discussion of updated guidelines for those with chronic kidney disease. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Koresh from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, your study analyzed blood pressure and other data from 1,700 adults with chronic kidney disease. What were your researchers looking to discover relative to the new guidelines?
What we wanted to do is use a representative sample of the U.S. population to see what patients with both hypertension and kidney disease, how their treatment related to the new guidelines. And for example, we found that nearly 9 million of the 24 million adults with elevated systolic blood pressure were not taking any antihypertensive medications, right? So for those individuals, making sure they get treated is critical. And then for a number of people who are taking just one medication, taking more medications was important as well. Of the 35 million adults in the U.S. with chronic kidney disease, 25 million have high blood pressure above the currently recommended guidelines. So that's 7 in 10 have blood pressure above the guidelines now. This is more than what used to be 50% before. Furthermore, we found that among those whose blood pressure was not adequately controlled, 9 of the 24 million were not taking any medications. So for them, the first step should be relatively easy, whereas for some people who are taking many medications, it may be harder.
Your study also found that Blacks and Asian Americans with chronic kidney disease are more likely than whites to have blood pressure readings above the latest guideline targets. Was the difference substantial, and do we know the cause?
We're not sure of the cause because we couldn't determine it in this study, but social determinants of health are important. We know that after decades of work, awareness of hypertension among African Americans has gotten to a good level. But actually, to get compliance, you have to have a system that works together, make sure that medications are affordable, make sure that the health system and the patients can connect in good ways. So I think people are working on that, and that's important.
When you say that 25 million with chronic kidney disease are, quote, eligible, unquote, for lowering their blood pressure, does this mean that they're in good enough physical condition to tolerate their medications?
We actually didn't have adequate data on side effects. At some point, not everybody will achieve their goal. But we had a fair amount of evidence to suggest that we can do better. And part of the thing is the guidelines are now recommending stricter and lower levels of blood pressure based on new clinical trial evidence in the last few years. So it really takes time for physicians to decide that they believe the evidence, act on the evidence, and then get the control and the benefit in patients. So I think there's quite a bit to catch up. Not everyone will be in control, but we have room for significant improvements.
And do you know or have a sense at least of how many of these 25 million people are eligible to control their high blood pressure with just diet or lifestyle changes?
Everybody's eligible for diet and lifestyle. And I think the truth is, if we were able to make dramatic diet and lifestyle changes with significant weight loss and significant reductions in salt, and that includes not just added salt, but salt in the food, we can make dramatic reductions in blood pressure. However, we've found that the realities of behavioral change are not easy. So we really pursue those and medications where often we can get compliance faster and easier, but really both can work very well.
Our guest today is Joseph Koresh, the George W. Comstock Professor in the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Of course, Doctor, one has to know if he or she has kidney disease in the first place. Is this a condition that is often not diagnosed?
I think you're completely correct. We need to improve diagnosis and recognition of chronic kidney disease. The two key tests for defining kidney disease is a blood test, which is called serum creatinine, which estimates your kidney function or glomerular filtration rate. Many people have that as part of routine testing, and they should just pay attention to the result on the lab sheet. The other key test is protein in the urine, and the key protein is called albumin. And too infrequently, patients don't get their urine tested. So if you have diabetes or hypertension and you're concerned about kidney disease, ask your doctor if you have kidney disease and make sure that a urine test is included.
How might our kidneys become damaged or diseased?
The leading risk factors are diabetes, and particularly when it's in poor control, and hypertension, particularly when it is in poor control. And over time, you get increased damage to the kidney that accelerates the average rate of decline. And once the kidney is damaged, it really increases the risk for a lot of complications, including heart disease, heart failure, and other outcomes.
I see that blood pressure control improved in the United States over much of the past two decades, but then in the last several years, it took a U-turn and got worse. First off, do we know why that is?
I think we're concerned that there were some confusing messages between some of the recent guidelines. Not the most recent guideline, but the one before that had some confusion as to whether older adults should really control their blood pressure to lower level or could relax to less strict criteria. The most recent evidence suggests that at any age, if you can achieve low blood pressure safely, you should. I also worry always that our healthcare system is so fragmented and complex. It's clear that in organized systems with clear monitoring systems, with signals to patients and physicians, control rates can be excellent. But too often we just don't meet those criteria, and I think we need to get a clear message to patients, physicians, and an organized system to achieve blood pressure goals and gain many benefits.
Do you believe that doctors might be less likely to recommend blood pressure medication? And if so, do we know why that might be?
I don't know the exact reasons. I think there are a lot of things on people's radar screens. It's a matter of, I think, blood pressure control may not be exciting, but it's important. And so I think it's a matter of having systems where a broad and, you know, varied range of skills is involved in both accurate measurement of blood pressure, prescription, and delivery of the therapy. And a good number of studies have shown that physician extenders and healthcare professionals, including pharmacists and community health workers, can help achieve excellent blood pressure controls.
And maybe part of that is public education. I've heard from doctors who fume about their patients just not following instructions, not taking their medication. Is that a piece of the puzzle?
Compliance is important, and that means that we need to attend to side effects, both real and perceived. And so we need to think about that and think about that specifically at each age group and each gender as to what might be the issues that patients have. We have a lot of options with blood pressure, both lifestyle and medications. So we can change medications, titrate doses, and it's been proven that with adequate programs, we can achieve dramatic results. But it does take determination, and I think you're right that communicating the importance to everybody is critical.
And finally, Doctor, are society's seemingly increasing fast food choices playing a role in more people having blood pressure that's too high?
Well, there's no doubt that high salt intake is a problem for high blood pressure. And most of the salt we get is in the food before we get to the food itself, in prepared foods, prepared ingredients. And fast food can be high in sodium because that's a cheaper option. Societally, if we can change that, it will change people's tastes and they will enjoy the food just as much at a lower sodium if that's done sort of chronically.
Dr. Joseph Koresh with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I want to thank you very much for joining us today with this important blood pressure information.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the attention to kidney disease and good blood pressure control.
Up next, a fascinating look at robotic-assisted heart surgery from a cardiovascular surgeon at the Mayo Clinic. Stay with us for more MedClinic Radio.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams.
Breast cancer is an entire spectrum of disease, from very low-grade DCIS all the way up to the other end of the spectrum, which is a very high-grade invasive tumor.
Dr. Amy Degnam says treatment depends on several factors, including what the cancer looks like under a microscope.
Some tumors have strong estrogen receptors on the outside of their tumor cells, and some tumors do not.
Cell receptors determine treatment options, which can be targeted to specific types of tumors.
In terms of creating treatment plans, it is quite complex.
Treatment plans may include surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and medication, depending on type, size, stage, location, and grade of tumor. Dr. Degnam says the good news is breast cancer is survived by most women. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
It sounds futuristic, but each year, Mayo Clinic surgeons perform about 120 cases of robotic-assisted heart surgery. With this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Advances in surgical techniques have made minimally invasive and robotic surgery an option for many heart surgery patients. Minimally invasive heart surgery is accomplished by making incisions in the right side of the chest and approaching the heart from between the ribs, instead of opening the sternum or breastbone, as is done in open heart surgery. So what makes someone a candidate for minimally invasive heart surgery? Well, we have just the person to tell us today. Dr. Philip Rouse is a cardiovascular surgeon at Mayo Clinic, and he's going to share information with us. Just by nature, and when people think about heart surgery, it sounds awfully invasive, like a really big deal. And so what do you mean when you say minimally invasive heart surgery?
Well, I think a key thing to know is that minimally invasive heart surgery or robotic assisted surgery, I would define as essentially performing a standard surgical operation through smaller incisions. And that's really important that individuals know that an operation is not compromised in any way if we change the approach through small incisions with minimally invasive or with the use of the robot. And so I think that's the key thing to first understand is that the operation is the same if it's open or minimally invasive.
So for our listeners, Philip, that might mean that they get the same procedure done, but that the healing time might be different.
Well, that's part of it. Absolutely. A standard sternotomy, an incision down the front and middle, usually keeps somebody in the hospital about 5 days. That's pretty average. And then they recover on the order of about 6 weeks. If somebody has a robotic assisted procedure, for example, let's say the mitral valve is diseased and is leaking and that valve needs to be repaired, We can do that with the aid of a robot. And those patients in general are in the hospital about 3 days and recover in about 3 weeks. So there is, you know, a significant advantage in terms of getting back to work and back on your feet.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, minimally invasive to me just means you don't make as big of an incision, which probably is not the complete story. But would you describe for us what the types of minimally invasive surgery include, and are they all robotic?
No, they're not all robotic. So a minimally invasive surgery, usually from a cardiac perspective, is coming from the right side of the chest. And we can do that with smaller incisions to, you know, either repair a tricuspid valve that's diseased or a mitral valve that's diseased. When we make the incisions very small, that's where the aid of the robot is very helpful. The size of the incisions in that case are about the size of a pencil. When we do the robotic approach, there really is no bone breaking, and the degree of muscle cutting is also significantly minimized. So minimally invasive can come from the right side with a little larger incision, but not go through the breastbone. But the robot can shrink those incisions down very small and really is the ultimate, if you will, with minimally invasive surgery.
So, Philip, I have to say that robots, it sounds a little futuristic or like artificial intelligence. Do surgeons still participate when a robot is involved? And is this something that will replace actually people doing surgery at some time?
Right. We have cars that drive themselves nowadays. What about robots? Are they doing the surgery? The robot, when we use it, there's three arms to the robot. And with each of those arms, there's a retractor or a needle driver or a forceps that can be utilized to do the procedure. And it's important to know that the robotic arms are really an extension of the surgeon's fingers. So the surgeon sits at a console, it's like a computer device, and with their fingers, they manipulate those arms. And very precisely, the robot replicates the surgeon's finger movements. And so the surgeon is performing the entire procedure with the aid of the robot. So the robot sort of follows what the surgeon's commands are.
So how does this differ from having what we think of as traditional open heart surgery, where we think of someone going in and having their vessels grafted or a valve replaced, something like that?
There are some key differences. And I guess the most obvious one is the size of the incision. You know, if we were to do a standard open procedure, which we've done since the 1950s. It's important to know that an open heart surgery down the front middle is done every day of the week. And in many cases, that's the preferred approach. So there's nothing wrong with a traditional open heart surgery down the front. But there are some differences in terms of the location. So we move the incision to the right side of the chest. And with the robot, they're very small. The other difference when we do robotic surgery here at Mayo, there's always two surgeons involved in the procedures. So I alluded to the robot and this sort of computerized device that the surgeon sits at and manipulates the robotic arms. Well, we have another surgeon at the bedside that assists those arms. And that's a key role that we always have a surgeon there. So there's some differences in terms of the number of surgeons involved in the case.
Clarify for us a little bit. You alluded to it a little bit earlier about what sorts of surgeries can you do through this minimally invasive technique. What would people ask about when they went to see a surgeon if it was a possibility for them?
I think the repertoire of those procedures are expanding. The most common one that we perform at Mayo is treating mitral valve disease. And the top of the list is usually a leaking or regurgitant mitral valve. And we can approach that with the use of the robot or minimally invasive with a smaller incision without going through the breastbone. We also treat tricuspid valve disease with either incision, the minimally invasive approach, or with the use of the robot. There are some smaller tumors in the heart that we can remove with the aid of the robot. There are a variety of congenital heart defects, the most common of which would be a little hole between the chambers of the heart that needs to be patched closed. In some cases, we can do single vessel bypass surgery with the aid of the robot. And so our repertoire really is expanding and we're becoming more comfortable with it. We've employed the robot at Mayo since 2008, and it's really been a great thing for both surgeons and patients.
Sounds amazing. Are there any characteristics of the patients themselves that make them more or less of a candidate to be able to have a robotic surgery versus an open surgery?
That's a very good question. And with every patient that we see at Mayo that we're considering the robotic approach to, there's a very highly rigorous selective process. I hate to use that term, but we always start with an echo test. We want to make sure that there's, you know, the valve disease that we can treat with the use of the robot and that there's not multivalve disease. If there's a stenotic or blocked up aortic valve and a leaking mitral valve. Well, that's a patient who should have open heart surgery down the front middle. We always do a CT scan, you know, from basically the upper chest down to the pelvis. To do robotic surgery, we still have to be on the heart-lung machine, just like the open heart surgery approach down the front middle. And so we need to make sure that there's not severe disease in the peripheral vasculature, the arteries and veins in the groin and the big vein in the neck that we use to put somebody on the heart-lung machine. We also want to make sure that the patient doesn't have severe coronary disease. If the heart arteries themselves are blocked up in multiple sites and they have a leaking tricuspid valve, for example, well, that's a patient that should have bypass surgery to the heart arteries and valve treatment with an open surgery. To do the operation I alluded to, we come from the right side of the chest. And to do that, we have to deflate the lung on that side. And in some patients who may have very severe lung disease, we may need to do a pulmonary function test, for example, to make sure that they would be able to tolerate doing that to create space for the robot. And I think the other thing that's important is the current technology with the robot is very good, but patients who are very small or on the larger side, the use of the robotic arms are somewhat limited right now. So we do look at those factors as well.
Philip, I remember when the robotic surgeries first were being developed, that it took a lot longer to perform the procedures. I'm thinking primarily of urologic procedures that I was involved with at that time as an anesthesiologist. Is it faster now to do robotic surgery, or what are some of the benefits other than what we talked about earlier with more rapid recovery, perhaps?
In some cases, the robot can be a little faster, but not all cases. I think they're about on par in terms of open heart procedures down the front middle. You know, we did talk about the faster recovery, the earlier return to work, but I wouldn't say that in every case the robot is faster. I think it's about on par with open procedures.
I know that if people have to go on to have subsequent heart surgeries, there used to be concern that if they'd had a sternotomy incision before or opening of their breastbone to approach the heart, that there was some risk with re-entering by that same approach. Does having had a robotic surgery initially help decrease that risk if someone needs subsequent surgery?
Having had robotic surgery from the side, there always is a little footprint left behind anytime you do surgery, and that footprint is scar tissue. I do think and do believe that there is a little less scarring when we come from the side. We don't fully expose the heart as you do an open heart surgery down the front middle. So I do think, you know, if there were the need for a second intervention, you know, down the road, down the front middle, then I think that that would be perhaps minimized in terms of risk with less scarring.
What are other risks that individuals should be aware of if they're considering candidacy for robotic surgery?
Well, risk for robotic surgery, I think, is the same for open heart surgery. The main risks really don't change much from that perspective. We are going through different routes to put a patient on the bypass circuit from the neck and down the groin. So there's some risk with getting access to those arteries and veins and not causing a problem there. And we do that relatively safely. We have not had any significant problems in terms of injuries to those vessels. And when we do robotic surgery, our mortality rate is far less than 0.5%. So we can do it quite safely, but we do go through that selective process that we talked about to carefully select patients for this approach.
If individuals are considering having robotic surgery, I would imagine that it is important to seek out a center where this is done frequently and where the surgeon has some skill and expertise in this area. Is it commonly available?
To your first point, skill and expertise is very critical. I think both in traditional open surgery, as well as in robotic or minimally invasive surgery. And we'll just take, you know, mitral valve for an example. In order to transition from being an open heart surgeon to a robotic surgeon, you really have to have a robust understanding of how to do the procedure in an open fashion. And that lends itself very well to translating to the use of the robot. So I think going to a center that has high volume and expertise in open approach and robotic approach to treatment of the same valve problem is very important. Of course, volume is very key. With mitral valve disease, we treat about 120 or more a year for the last 4 to 5 years at Mayo Clinic robotically. A part of that volume is having a cohesive team, you know, where we have dedicated anesthesiologists that they are part of the robotic team. We have dedicated cardiologists who are in the room performing the echo tests at the time of surgery and right afterwards, as well as our, you know, allied health staff, you know, in the ICUs and the step down areas. So I think having a very cohesive team is part of that whole process.
You know what you said about being proficient in doing the procedure in an open fashion, maybe even before becoming a robotic surgeon, sort of piqued my interest and made me think that I could imagine scenarios where you might start a robotic surgery and have to convert it to an open surgery. I don't know how often that happens, but obviously you'd want a surgeon who is facile in doing the technique either way.
That's right. And fortunately, we haven't had many conversions, but we have had few. And usually that's the case of, you know, an unexpected complication. Maybe we needed to explore the artery in the groin or the cannulation up into the neck, you know, some unexpected event, but those incidences are very low.
How can our listeners find out more information?
We are on Facebook at Robotic Heart Surgery Mayo Clinic. You can find us at Twitter at Mayo Clinic Cardiac Surgery. And if you go to Mayo Clinic website and in the search bar type in robotic heart surgery, you'll find a list of other sites to see videos and link to us. And a bit archaic, you could pick up the phone and talk to any one of us. There's 5 robotic surgeons here at Mayo, and we're happy to have any conversation with the referring provider or the patient themselves, and we'd be glad to make that happen.
Well, that's wonderful. What a fascinating conversation today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon, Dr. Philip Rouse, for being here with us today to discuss minimally invasive heart surgery.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is a production of the Mayo Clinic News Network and is available wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org, then click podcasts. Up next, an average of 32 calls come into poison control centers each day for opioid emergencies involving children. We'll have important advice that every parent should hear next on MedClinic Radio.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Prescription drug abuse is a national problem, particularly involving opioid drugs. A study shows that children can be victims of these drugs. Henry A. Spiller is director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital and co-author of the study. Henry, welcome to MedClinic Radio.
Thank you.
Let's start with the numbers. How many calls do poison centers get about this specific problem?
We looked a lot. We looked over a 15-year period, and we had 188,000. This is more than 10,000 a year. It's significant.
When you say children are exposed to prescription opioids, what exactly are we talking about?
Unfortunately, that's a term we use in poison centers. You can take a substance, you can inject it, insufflate it or snort it, ingest it. And so we use the general term exposure. These are children who have taken an opioid.
Okay, so they have taken it, but presumably most prescription drugs arrive in sealed containers or those with safety caps. How are the children getting access to these so easily?
Unfortunately, they're not. There's two groups that really stick out in this, and one is children that are younger than 6, preschoolers. They're around the home. That's about half of this group, almost 100,000. And in this case, they're just doing exploratory behavior. They're wandering around their house. They're delightfully exploring their world, and they find these pills. They are not locked up, unfortunately, and they do what they often do. They look at them. They put them in their mouth, that sort of thing. That's one area we hope education can help, because they're finding these. The second group is actually teens, 14, 15, 16, all the way to 18. All of their exposures, as we call them, are intentional. And they're doing it for two main reasons. One is abuse. I mean, they're taking it to get high. The other is we saw suicide attempts. But again, all these children don't have direct access to go to a doctor and go to a pharmacy themselves. These are found in the home. And so that's a big picture of what we're seeing, is that people need to be very careful about these medications when they have them in their house.
Henry, which specific medications are most commonly involved in these cases?
It depends on the age group. In this study, we're looking at prescription opioids. So illicit opioids like heroin are not part of this. These are pills found in the home, that sort of thing. In the older ones, it's oxycodone and hydrocodone. But in young children, we found a very concerning trend. And it's actually one of the few that's actually increasing the whole way through the study. And that's buprenorphine. You may know that as Suboxone. And Suboxone is only used in the U.S. as a treatment for opiate addiction. So this is being brought into the home of a parent or a family member or someone who previously had some sort of opiate addiction and now has this in their home. And then the children are getting into the buprenorphine. And we're seeing a significant increase in just the children under five. You don't see it in any other group. It's concerning. And there's a little reason why. When you give this, it's the adult. It's not usually considered as potent as some of the other things they were taking. It doesn't give the distinct high that some of the other things they were using. And they may not consider it as potent or powerful. Perhaps that's why it's available. They're not as careful with it, but it is in these very young children. And more than half of them end up in the hospital because of this.
Well, you bring up an interesting question. Are these opioids leftover drugs from an old prescription? And how should someone dispose of these drugs once they're no longer needed?
Unfortunately, we don't have in this database if this was their prescription or someone else's prescription. But in either case, it should be something that's controlled in the house. If they're left over, and in many cases, parents may just save these. Apparently, it's evident with 188,000 cases, the kids are watching, and they know that this is still in the medicine cabinet. The adolescents are going there and taking them, and the young children are just finding them. So we would suggest if you have these and you're going to keep them in your house, put it in a locked box, and then therefore you'd have to open it to use it. You don't need a big safe or anything, but these lock boxes are cheap, they're easy, and that would help a great deal.
What's your view on how many opioids are being prescribed by doctors? Do you feel these drugs are perhaps overused?
Since 2010, there's been significant efforts to reduce and control this. For instance, a number of specific specialties, like emergency medicine and others, have requested that their groups prescribe for just, say, 2 days or 3 days. You know, 8-12 tablets of that nature. A number of these things to reduce the, instead of just giving you a random 30 or 60 amounts and you have all this left over. So in many cases, and there's been tracking by the states called prescription monitoring programs. And so since 2010, there's been a significant reduction. And in fact, in everything except buprenorphine, we also saw after 2010 a reduction. And it's down to about 10,000 cases last year, which is an improvement. I mean, if you see the trend, it is definitely improving, and we're happy with this, but it's obviously still there.
Henry, compared to other calls that the poison centers get for opioids, what would be the second biggest cause of poisoning? Is it household cleaning products, or is it something else that's next on the list?
It depends on the age group. In children, yeah, it would be household products. In young children, 0 to 5, in adolescents, it is other pharmaceuticals, a lot of cough cold preparation, dextromethorphan, antihistamines that they use.
Tell us about changes you'd like to see in how opioid drugs are packaged.
It's another tool that we're hoping will help. You know, if you have individual blister packs, it certainly will cut down on how many a toddler can get in a period of time. If you just open a bottle, they might be able to swallow 5, 6, 7 before you can get to them. It's a blister pack. Hopefully, if you're in the, you know, the house, the room, you wander in, and it takes them a little time. It's a method to slow down access for young children that would help. Another key thing would be a lockbox. These are additional tools that will help us.
As we wrap this up, Henry, I'm just wondering if you have any words of advice for parents.
I honestly want to let them know that this really occurs. We're still seeing 10,000 cases a year across the U.S. And the adolescents, they may not have wanted to do it when they were 10, 2 years ago, or 4 years ago, but now they're 14 or 15. You need to be aware that they may try and do this. And again, the young children, these are far more dangerous than perhaps you're used to. And to be, again, very cautious with them. It does occur, in our case, once every 45 minutes throughout the U.S. So this is daily, and it continues to occur.
Henry A. Spiller, director of the Central Ohio Poison Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week's MedClinic Radio, produced by Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week for more MedClinic Radio. Syndication Networks.